Thank you for helping us make Budget Again last year. Thanks to your support, Lutheran Public Radio has been independent and in the black for more than 2.5 years. You've heard us say, now only our listeners can cancel us, and we mean it. Thanks for listening, thanks for your prayers, thanks for your financial support, and we're looking forward to standing with you again in 2011. Christ-centered, cross-focused talk radio for the world. Issues, etc.
We are certainly aware of a recent string of attacks against Christians from Iraq to Egypt to Nigeria.
I'm not some kind of a psychic, so I want everybody to understand that, but I ask God for direction, and He very graciously gives it to me from time to time.
I think you can expect tremendous material coming from the mainstream press this year focusing on the Democrats have learned their lesson and they're going to try to get religion again.
I don't know where we got this. He hates sin but loves the sinner. He damned sinners. And were it not for Christ, that would be the last word. That would be all there is.
Indiana truck drivers, lobbyists, etc.
Have you found yourself just a wee bit disturbed? Maybe in the last decade or so, a lot of books have come out claiming to be or to introduce or to lay out a scenario in which lost or suppressed books of the Bible are suddenly rediscovered. Some of them have been discovered a long time ago. Some of these are really ancient books like the Gospel of Thomas. But we're told that they are books that were lost but do belong in the Bible. Is there any way to respond to that? Someone has a Gospel of Thomas that dates back to, say, 200? That's pretty old. Does it belong in the Bible? If it doesn't, how do you argue that it doesn't? Greetings and welcome to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We'll spend the first half hour getting Greg Kokel's answer to the question, do we have lost books that need to be either put back into the Bible, supplement the Bible, correct what's already there? And then we'll play Issues, Etc. Soundbite of the Year. That's a little bit bigger than Soundbite of the Week. Every Friday we play Soundbite of the Week, 4 soundbites for you to listen to and then to vote on. You get to pick Soundbite of the Week every week. Well, we've come to the end of 2010, and the first week here of 2011, we're going to let you pick Soundbite of the Year. We've got the top 5 vote-getters from this last year in the Soundbite competition. We're going to play them for you, and we're going to let you pick Soundbite of the Year, and we're going to give away the LPR bundle package, which is an I Have Issues t-shirt, and Issues, Etc., travel mug, pin, and bumper sticker, plus 2 books to the best vote for Soundbite of the Year. We're coming to you live this Friday afternoon, January the 7th. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Greg Kokel is our guest. He's founder and president of Stand to Reason. Based in Signal Hill, California, he's author of the book Tactics, A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions, and he's also written an article in the latest Solid Ground newsletter titled No Lost Books. Greg, welcome back.
Todd, Happy New Year to you.
And to you as well.
Good to talk with you.
It only stands to reason because we know, like Paul admits, that there's letters there that were circulating in the New Testament that haven't survived to us. It only stands to reason that there are other lost books and that perhaps these other lost books needed to supplement, maybe even correct some of what we got in the present canon. How do you respond?
Well, it looks like Paul, based on his references in 1 and 2 Corinthians, actually wrote 2 other letters that didn't survive for us. Of course, that's not a problem from our perspective, from our view on inspiration, because we don't hold that every single thing that any apostle penned was meant to be canon scripture, that is, the rule for the church, essentially, only those things that survived. So there certainly could be ancient manuscripts that were written by different people about the time of Jesus or even by apostles that did survive. But whether or not there are lost books of the Bible, that's a different issue. And I use the phrase advisedly because, Todd, this is the way it's sometimes dramatically presented in books you might see in the bookstore or articles you might see in U.S. News and World Report or something like that. We've discovered lost books of the Bible. And my contention is that is not possible, and you don't have to even read the books in question to know that they can't be lost books of the Bible. They might be lost books of antiquity, I admit that. And in fact, we have uncovered things that previously we didn't have. But whether they fall under the rubric or the heading of Bible is an entirely different matter. And that depends entirely on what it is you mean by that term.
Okay, I want to come back to that in just a second. But
okay,
for those who aren't familiar, what are the claims here? What specific books are we talking about? How ancient are they? And how, as you said, how are they often misrepresented when they're sprung on the public at the Barnes & Noble or whatever bookstore?
Yeah, there's a whole slew of works that look like they go back to the 2nd and 3rd centuries, and our best assessment of them, the Gospel of Thomas is the most famous one. It was uncovered in the Nag Hammadi Library in Egypt. It survived for a long time because it's so dry there. This is about 100 years ago, well, not quite, about 80 years ago that they discovered these, or 70 years ago, but it was a whole library of ancient texts. The significant thing about Thomas is that it has a lot of sayings of Jesus, alleged sayings of Jesus, that are not found in the canonical text of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, although there is a little bit of overlap. So here is one that people might say is a contender for a primitive gospel that is a lost book of the Bible. Just a few years ago, we had the Gospel of Judas unearthed, or at least made public, and that created a bit of a stir because then people are wondering, gee, is this another representation of Christ's life that we were not allowed to consider in terms of reconstructing Jesus' own life? Because the Gospel of Judas certainly gives a bit of a different perspective on Jesus, as does Thomas compared to the canonical Gospels. And then in between those, you got a whole bunch of them, and many people are familiar with some of these texts because they were made reference to by Dan Brown in the Da Vinci Code, and they got some public play there, you know, the Gospel of Mary, the Gospel of Philip, and these kinds of things. And so then the question becomes, gee, have we been without lost books of the Bible, and are these the kinds of things that we should be considering on par with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in terms of their representation of the life of Christ?
And you're not saying that these books aren't worth studying in some sort of sense. I mean, I during my seminary training, might have been a postgraduate course I took on the Nag Hammadi Library. We read
right.
The things, we studied them, we actually looked at them in their original languages as a matter of scholarly interest, but not
sure.
As a matter of theological interest. If
yeah,
you will.
That's really the point here. I mean, I have, turning around looking at books now, I have the Gospel of Thomas here, I've got the Gospel of Judas here, I have these books from that period of time, and these books are curiosities. They might tell us something about the theological beliefs of the people who wrote them. Most of these books, as you know, Todd, do not represent the theology of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but rather theology that developed later in the second century called Gnosticism, which is, even though it talks about Jesus and is a spiritual religious view that has some kinship, in a sense, with Christianity, it diverges from Christianity in very critical points. And the early apologists, like Irenaeus, actually wrote vigorously against those views. And so that's why we're not surprised when we see the Gospel of Judas, for example, because those early Christian apologists wrote about their existence, even though we didn't have them in hand until recently, and said, yeah, they're around, and they're spurious. They're not reliable. They are defective theologically and not accurate representations of the life of Jesus.
So let's come back to that term Bible. You say it can only mean two things. What are they?
Well, the Christians, of course, when they mean Bible, they are talking about a book that represents God's communication to man. In other words, God worked through human authors in such a way as to produce documents that, even though they reflected the author's individual styles or research or efforts, it's not automatic writing, they weren't just channeling language down onto the page, even though there's a human element involved, God worked in a supernatural fashion so that these men wrote exactly what God intended them to write in the originals. And so this is what we mean when we say verbal plenary inspiration, that the words themselves were inspired, God breathed, and that the whole thing was inspired. The full canon that we have was inspired by God in that sense. Now, what's key about this definition, and there are people who don't accept this, obviously, and I understand that, but this is one of the definitions. We'll get to the naturalistic definition in a moment. But one of the definitions, one way of understanding the word Bible, is it is the book that God gave. And the reason that the wording here is important, Todd, and this perspective or this understanding of Bible, is that many people will be dismissive of biblical claims because they say, well, men wrote it, and men make mistakes. Well, it's certainly true that men do make mistakes, but it is not true that men always make mistakes. And so that criticism, first of all, has the assumption that just because men wrote it, it must be in error, and it can't be trusted. And when people raise that question, I always ask them if they have any books in their own library, which they always say yes, because everybody's got a couple of books. And then I ask, who wrote those books? Well, human beings wrote those books in every single case, but they don't toss them in the trash just because they had human authors. No, they assess them. So I think the challenge itself is a poor challenge to begin with, but it misses the point of the first definition. Because the first definition is that God was the one who is ultimately responsible for the final product. And if God is responsible for the final product, gosh, Todd, it doesn't matter whether men or monkeys wrote it, you know. God is still powerful enough to ensure the final result. So that would be the first definition of Bible, that the Bible is a book that is superintended and overseen by the omnipotent God of the universe himself.
All right, when we come back, we'll get to the second definition, and we'll find out why. No matter which definition you use, it's impossible for there to be lost books of the Bible. Greg Kokel of Stand to Reason is our guest. It's Friday afternoon, January the 7th. We'll be right back. Thank you for helping us make Budget Again last year. Thanks to your support, Lutheran Public Radio has been independent and in the black for more than 2.5 years. You've heard us say, now only our listeners can cancel us, and we mean it. Thanks for listening, thanks for your prayers, thanks for your financial support, and we're looking forward to standing with you again in 2011. Christ-centered, cross-focused talk radio for the world. Issues, etc.
Did you know that you can listen to Issues, etc. 24/7? Check out our website, issuesetc.org, and go to the Listen On Demand page. Listen at the gym, in your kitchen, in your garden, on your iPod, your computer, or in your car. The technology may be new, but the truth never changes. Issues, etc. on-demand audio available for your convenience at issuesetc.org. 10 hours of new programming each week. issuesetc.org and click Listen On Demand.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, etc.
The latest edition of the online Issues, etc. journal is out. It contains an article that I've written titled The Theology of Jesus. What's the connection between the Church's Confession of Christ and her Confession of the Trinity? Find out with the latest Issues, Etc. journal. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Pastor Mason Beecroft writes about the false promises of Pop American Christianity. Get your copy of the latest Issues, Etc. journal by sending your name and email address to journal@issuesetc.org.
Would you like to share something you've heard on Issues, Etc. via email, Facebook, Twitter, or text message? We've made it easy for you. Just go to the Listen On Demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, and click Share This. You'll find almost 50 ways to share Issues, Etc. audio. We love our on-demand listeners. Old Theology, New Technology, issuesetc.org. Go to the Listen On Demand page and click Share This.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. Greg Kokel is our guest. We're answering the question, are there lost books of the Bible? Before the break, Greg, you said that there's only two definitions for this word Bible, and much of the answer to that question hinges on how you define it. What's the second definition of Bible that we need to be aware of to answer this question?
Yeah, the other definition would be what kind of the rest of the world thinks about the Bible, that, well, maybe it's a, you know, a nice book or a good book or have some wisdom and whatever, or maybe it doesn't, but what it turns out to be is just an expression of what a group of people in the first and second centuries understood to be true about theology. So it was their views. It was their authoritative set of works, if you will. Now, and in this sense, the word Bible, it can be applied to lots of different disciplines, I guess. You could have, I mean, I had a book once, it was called The Fisherman's Bible, you know. It was no claim to divine authority. It was just meant to be the kind of standard. This is what you could go to get all your information. And so this would be the second definition. The thing that the Bible is just simply this collection of books that the early church fathers thought for themselves at that time represented their own views. Primitive Christianity. And in this situation, by the way, it would be entirely appropriate for them to take something like the Gospel of Thomas and toss it in the trash, which they did, along with a whole bunch of those others, because they did not think it reflected their own particular theological convictions. And since it didn't reflect their theological convictions, they toss it out. It's kind of like if you were to write a book yourself, Todd, about your own theology, and maybe you had lots of notes about lots of musings, but some of those notes you just thought, yeah, these don't reflect my views anymore, I'm tossing them in the trash. And then somebody dug through the trash and found your notes and said, I've got Todd Wilkins' lost notes of his theological beliefs. And you say, they're not lost, they're discarded. Because I don't actually believe those. So those aren't lost books that the early church fathers tossed out. Those are simply books that they did not believe comported with their theological view. Now let me bring this together and show you how these definitions help us understand how to answer the challenge. If people say there are lost books of the Bible, and the word Bible can only be either supernaturally defined as Christians do it, or naturalistically defined as non-Christians do it, I think you're going to have problems in either case with saying that there are lost books. How can God, for example, if the Bible turns out to be a book that is supernaturally inspired by the omnipotent God of the universe, how can God lose his books? You know, how can he misplace one? I mean, that's like saying that the all-powerful God is not all-powerful, which is a contradiction. If God is in fact involved in the process and superintends the process, and if we can give good reasons to believe that that's been the case, then it seems to me to be contradictory then to claim that there could be lost books of that kind of Bible. Yeah, there may be a couple of letters that Paul wrote that we don't have, but in God's sovereign omnipotent wisdom, he purposed not to preserve them for posterity because he didn't intend the church to use them as canon scripture, as authoritative scripture for the church for history. And that's why they fell out of circulation. So in the first definition, it seems impossible that there could be lost books. But what about the second, the lost books of the Bible? There could be lost books, but not lost books of the Bible. What about the second definition of Bible? Can there be lost books in the sense that there were books that the early church fathers thought reflected their own views but didn't save them? And my response is, no, I don't see how that can be the case. The books that were discarded and lost were discarded and lost because they did not fit the views of the early church. Not because they did. And in fact, some would point out that because there were political motivations of the early church, because they thought these guys were heretics, you know, the Gnostics, then this somehow is a mark against the early church. It's actually a mark in our favor. It is meant to prove that these books did not, in fact, comport with their definition of Bible in the naturalistic sense. So no matter how you define the Bible, supernaturally or naturalistically, it seems that there can be no lost books of the Bible. There could be lost books of antiquity. There could be interesting books that we discover that might tell us something about culture or about some aberrant theology of the time. But lost books of the Bible, no.
Okay, can you deal with one more? And that is kind of people who know exactly, as you've outlined it so clearly, exactly how the, what shall we say, vetting process over that several centuries actually functioned in the life of the living church there, so that in the end they do have, in this case, say, the New Testament canon. They'll say, ah, but what you call rejection, I call suppression. They suppressed these books, and it really was political, and it really was about Constantine wanting a certain kind of power, and you know the story. Dan Brown tells it in a very sweeping way. What's the quickest response to that?
The curious thing about Constantine is he initially supported the heretical view of Arius, you know, so, I mean, that doesn't work historically. But my simple response is just to nod yes, okay, not rejection, suppression. Yeah, they suppressed them. So what? How does that change the equation at all? They suppressed them because they believed they were theologically aberrant and dangerous to the Christian community. So okay, you might say, well, there were bad people for suppressing it. If that's the perspective you want to have, you're welcome to it. But that doesn't change the equation in any way. They were suppressed. They were destroyed. And they were destroyed in some cases, because they were false characterizations of the life of Christ. In other words, they weren't accurate as to their representing of Jesus. So that's a historical issue that's represented there. The people closest to the events said that these things did not accurately represent the events. In addition to that, they were theologically aberrant, and it was entirely appropriate for that community to suppress theologically aberrant material by destroying it, just like it would be for any other theological community to suppress theologically aberrant material within their religious community. We're not talking, you know, I think that's completely legitimate. They get to define for themselves, even on a naturalistic take, Todd, they get to define for themselves what they think is the legitimate theology for their group.
Let me toss one in there and just get your reaction to it. This is one that I think is compelling, especially with regard to the four Gospels, because that's often where these things are tossed in.
Right.
And this was made by a guest on the program some time back. He said, look, if you look at the codices, the actual bound books that the New Testament church very early was using with regard to those books, you will see Matthew, Mark, and Luke. You'll see Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You'll see Matthew and Mark. You'll see Luke and John. You'll see all these different combinations of these four books bound together and traveling about the church, circulating. You never find Matthew, Mark, and Thomas.
Right.
You never find Thomas and John. You never find any of these claimed books, Gospels, traveling, if you will, with the canonical ones. What do you think of that argument?
Yeah, well, that actually is a great argument in favor of our view, and sometimes you have to use circumstantial evidence to try to figure these things out. And if you look at the characterizations of the canon from the earliest time, and not all of them are complete, because you have some early church fathers that are just writing about some and giving the nod to some, and others that are giving the nod to others. I think you have a fairly complete list of what we consider the canon now, late in the second century. But it is interesting to note that you do not find these spurious pieces. What you do find sometimes coupled in with the standard readings of the early church were works that were not considered spurious, but there was some question as to whether they were actually inspired by God. So you have the Didache, for example, or the Shepherd of Hermas, and some of these others. These were valuable devotional tools that were not aberrant. There was just some question as to whether or not they were divinely inspired and on level with canon. And the church eventually uniformly rejected them in that sense, even though they accepted them for their devotional value. So, but this observation you're making is a fine one, that you don't see this kind of mixture in any of these combinations of what are clearly later texts, Gospel of Thomas, second century or later, and all these others that come in there, because these seem to be things that were written late by people who were not in touch with the facts, but were promoting under the name of Jesus or some of the other apostles like Thomas, promoting an aberrant theology not consistent with the early church.
Greg Kokel is founder and president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. He's author of the book Tactics, A Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions. And he's also written an article in the latest Solid Ground newsletter titled No Lost Books. You can receive Stand to Reason's free Solid Ground newsletter by calling 1-800-2-REASON. 1-800-2-REASON. Greg, thanks for being our guest.
Todd, all the best to you.
All right, when we come back, it's time for Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Year. We only do this once a year. We do it right at the beginning of the year, or you could look at it the end of the old year. Soundbite of the Year 2010, here in the first week of 2011. We've come to the end of the week, and it's time, when we come back, we'll play five soundbites for you. They're the top vote getters from 2010, all of them winners in their own right. We just brought together all the top vote getters. We'll play them for you, and then you get to pick soundbite of the year here on Issues Etc. 1-877-623-MYIE, 877-623-6943. Those who vote via the phone get to vote first. You can also vote via email, talkback@issuesetc.org. We'll get your email in real time, or also in real time, our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Soundbite of the year, your pick. When we come back.
Think big screens belong in the movie theater, not at church? Think garage bands should stay in the garage, not be jamming in front of the altar? Hey, we do too. Come join us at St. Paul Lutheran Church of Hamel, Illinois, for services that are reverent and relevant, vibrant and traditional. Divine service on Saturday at 6 p.m., on Sunday morning at 7:45 and 10, with Sunday school and Bible class in between at 9. Join us. Not a big screen or garage band in sight. Promise.
Pop spirituality teaches you to look inside yourself. True spirituality teaches you to look outside yourself to the person and work of Jesus Christ. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January is titled Lutheran Spirituality, Life as God's Child. You can purchase Lutheran Spirituality by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse before you buy at our website, issuesetc.org, Lutheran Spirituality.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Luann's Law.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
When the actions of an Arizona abortion doctor and clinic left one mother of two dead after a botched abortion, the state enacted new regulations. Together, these came to be known as Luann's Law, after the woman who lost her life. Basically, the state legislature adopted comprehensive minimum health and safety regulations for abortion clinics operating in Arizona. Due to legal action by Planned Parenthood, the 10-year-old laws just recently took effect. Thankfully, women in Arizona now have more protection against substandard conditions at some abortion clinics. Too bad it took one mother's death to achieve it.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.